Word of mouth.
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 Real duck with
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The digital age has rendered letter writing, paperboys, and checkbooks as old-fashioned as the rotary phone, while the proliferation of e-books, email, and online newspapers appears to be hastening the death of the printed page. Nicholas Bass-Baines argues that we are far from becoming a paperless society. He's an impassioned bibliophile and author of On Paper, The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History. And we have much more to talk about. Nicholas Bass-Baines, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Great pleasure to be here.
With the release of Amazon's Kindle in 2007, we heard all sorts of speculation. The death of books, you know, death of indie bookstores, shuttered libraries, and the printed page. You discovered that this is not the first time people imagined a paperless society. Tell us about the other incidences.
Well, they've been talking about paperless societies for at least 40 years. I can document at least 40. And that was exactly the prediction. The paperless society is upon us. It's imminent. And this is even before the digital revolution and the internet began to introduce all these various methods of reading and record keeping. But people could see where the direction was going, but it just hasn't turned out that way. Paper is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. As I point out in my book, there are 20,000 identifiable commercial uses of paper in the world today. Last year, there were 400 million metric tons of paper produced in the world, more than half of it used here in the United States and in China and Japan. So I don't think paper is disappearing from the landscape anytime soon.
I have to say I was a bit stunned to hear that paper is doing so well. What are some of the uses that we may not think about that paper is being used for?
I don't think it's things that you don't think of. It's just things that you take for granted. I mean, if you use a postage stamp, you're using paper. If you enjoy tea in the evening, a tea bag is made with paper. Its use for hygienic purposes goes without question. And I think all of your listeners would probably agree that we're talking about an indispensable item there in their daily lives. There are just so many uses. There is one company in Pennsylvania I write about, the P.H. Glatfelter Company, which had been a traditional paper maker for more than 100 years, going back to the 1860s. It's five generations. About 15 years ago, they decided and there's no mistaking, by the way, that with the electronic revolution that we've been encountering, that newsprint has declined. Books, conventional books as we know them, have declined. Magazines are on the edge. But this company, Glatfelter, which had been the premier manufacturer of paper for books, decided to diversify. And so within starting in about 1998, so that's 15 years or so, their net sales have gone from $569 million to $1.7 billion a year. And they did this by dominating certain fields. They make 75% of the paper used in the world for tea bags. They make maybe 80% of the paper for U.S. postage stamps. They make just about all of the paper for Hallmark greeting cards. They make wrapping paper for Reese's peanut butter cups and Hershey candy bars. And the list goes on and goes on and goes on. But this company estimates that the average American on a daily basis touches paper made in one of their mills, just the Glatfelter mill, and they are by no means at all the largest paper maker in the United States, at least 30 products made with their paper. And so it's not things that you would normally say, gee, I don't realize paper is used for that. I think it's just that we take so much of it for granted and don't really realize that it's there and that we rely on so enormously.
I think it was after an article that you'd written or an op-ed that you'd written, somebody had posted something about working for a state agency, and they were going through the old files and they were throwing out boxes of files, and they said to the supervisor, I'd like to throw out this box of files, and the supervisor says, okay, we'll just make two copies of them.
You know, there are statistics that were just released within, I've cited them in that op-ed piece in the LA Times that I think you're referencing.
Yes, exactly.
That on the governmental level, and I'm not just talking the federal, but all states and local governmental levels, produce right now in 2013, on average, 400 sheets of paper, either a xerographic copy or whatever, 400 sheets of paper every year for every individual in the United States of America. How many billions of pieces of paper you know, does that amount to, and what is supposed to be and what is purported to be, a paperless record-keeping bureaucracy?
If Nicholas Basbains, if we're going for a paperless society, should we be concerned about that? I mean, you're making the case that paper is alive and well, but
I just cite the facts and the uses of it.
But production and destruction take a lot of energy, right?
Well, what can I say about that? It's an essential manufactured material. I think most of the paper produced in the United States today is recycled paper, by the way. It's more than half. And paper, as I point out in the historical section of the book, paper as it was invented, as it was conceived in China 2,000 years ago, used recyclable material. It's the first industrial product I can think of that really does use to a great extent recyclables. The first paper made in China, it used frayed fishnets, old cordage from hemp rope, and also what they call virgin fiber was the inner bark of the paper mulberry tree. So that was the first formula for making paper. Paper requires a cellulosic source of fiber.
As a medium, however, paper is delicate. Print does fade. Paper disintegrates.
Strong, very strong, though. It's the beauty. I don't mean to interrupt, but paper, it does all of those things. You can fold it. You know, just think about that. And I'm not just talking about origami, which I write about also in the book, but think of how this affected the bureaucracy, the Ottomans, who basically introduced the modern bureaucracy. And it was during that period that you see bureaucracy in a concept that we understand being developed, where you see government being done over long distances through paperwork, and it was because you could fold it. You could write on it, and really it was counterfeit proof according to the technology of the day. They didn't have pencils. Once you put ink on paper, you couldn't erase it. This really allowed for a lot of things to happen.
Well, obviously, you have an emotional attachment or an aesthetic to paper.
Yeah, carried
but,
away with the subject.
Well, I want to ask if that's been underestimated by all of us. I mean, we do. With each new technological development, we have a new eulogy for books and newspapers and magazines and even the classroom. Has our collective emotional attachment to paper been underestimated, do you think?
Well, you know, books are still doing well. It is ironic, I have to say, that my book titled On Paper is available in an
electronically. I noticed that.
And I know for myself, I prefer reading a book in the very traditional, conventional manner. I like the artifact. I like to feel this thing in my hands. And I also maintain, and this is something that really is kind of under the radar, when you think about it, a document that is born digital. You know, it just exists as zeros and ones and as little electronic impulses. What kind of a preservative medium is that? Are you confident that 500 years from now, 100 years from now, even 50 years from now, that a document that is born digitally will be there, will be accessible, that you'll have the software to read it? You know, I've handled a Gutenberg Bible. Gutenberg Bible is the first Bibles made by produced, printed by Gutenberg were in the 1450s. I handled William Scheide's copy in Princeton, New Jersey, when I was writing one of my earlier books. And, you know, it's just as beautiful today as it was when it was first produced, the paper, which is wonderful rag paper. It's lasted for over 500 years. Can you say that? Can you honestly say that will be the case with material that is born digitally? And again, at the National Archives, the National Archivist told me, when you have a document that really matters and you are looking for an archival copy, even if it is born digital, guess what? They make a paper copy of it. So I think that speaks eloquently enough for itself as to whether or not it has a future.
Nicholas Basbains, paper evangelist and author of On Paper, the everything of its 2,000-year history. Great to speak with you.
Well, thanks. This has been a lot of fun.
You can find a link to read his op-ed, A Paperless Society, Not So Fast, and more about the book at wordofmouthradio.org. And how about you? Have you gone paperless yet? Are you an e-reader, or do you prefer to wrap your hands around a good old-fashioned book made of paper? You can let us know on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Well, you don't even need paper to get in on the early bird portion of NHPR's car raffle. You can make a call or do it online. Here's somebody to tell you how.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back in the spring, we explored New Hampshire's many town transfer stations with the writer Mike Morin and discovered they're not just places to deposit trash, but to connect with the community.
It is about conversation, and it's a very social setting. It's almost like a bar without the drinks.
And in our next story, the draw of the dump reaches even further, bringing the relationship of two neighbors to a whole new level. Here's Todd Bookman with more.
Caitlin Selby and Swift Corwin share 30 years of history. It's a history that started innocently enough with a new address.
We moved to Peterborough in about 1984, and Caitlin was about 11. No, she was about 10 years old at the time.
Nine. He and his wife and their newborn son moved in next to us on High Street. And we kind of shared a backyard.
Caitlin may have had a very rich and rewarding childhood before Swift, but as they tell it, life seems to have gotten a lot better after he arrived. His family quickly grew, and there were other kids from the block, and Caitlin and everybody, this whole pack of neighborhood friends, would romp around the connected backyards. As she grew up, Caitlin got closer to Swift's family, eventually becoming their babysitter. He taught her how to windsurf. His wife was her swim coach. Their lives were intertwined. So when Caitlin moved back to Peterborough at age 27, after college and marriage, there was some unseen force pulling her back to Swift. She and her husband wound up renting a house diagonal to the house Swift was now living in, and for 10 more years, they were again neighbors, spending a lot of time together.
One night, he was at our house watching TV. They didn't have TV at their house, so Swift would come to our house to watch TV and notoriously fall asleep every night in the same chair.
I was watching the Red Sox, and I was asleep watching the Red Sox. And
Beth, his wife, called frantically, screaming.
We had sheep in our backyard, these two sheep. And
the sheep in the pool, the sheep in the pool.
Then I got the, Swift, one of your sheep is in the pool.
The sheep in the pool, the sheep in the pool.
And I said, oh, God. And I sort of stumbled out of their house, and sure enough, when I got back, the sheep was out of the pool. My daughter had pulled it out by its horns. And anyway, we should have never had sheep in the middle of the town. It didn't work out very well.
The sheep are long gone by the time Caitlin moves. After spending half of her life living next to Swift, she finally cuts the cord and buys a home on the other side of the small downtown. But the connection, the pull between Swift and Caitlin, remains squarely in place, and it springs up again one Saturday morning.
So my daughter Lucy and I went to the dump to look for tapes for a birthday party we were going to, and we were supposed to bring tapes. So, you know, was looking through the swap shop like I normally do, and in between Wham and Sting was a copy of an old mixtape that just said Swift Corwin's poetry. And of course I grabbed it. And then my daughter Lucy and I put it in the tape player of our car and started listening to it. And if I can get this to work.
Paintbrush wisps on orange gold feathers, clouds, the sky deepening its blue as night falls. Indian paintbrush and marsh marigolds, wildflowers along the way. A boy with handlebar streamers out to play, in summer's last light, school's first day ending.
It was just before my dad died. I got this idea to write this, or to make this tape to my parents, to my father in particular, because I'd had a kind of a hard time communicating with him. He'd actually had a stroke. And I thought that it would be a great thing to just write, to say some poems into this tape.
Where are all the girls to take home? Which ones will Ho make? Through the small New England town on the 5th of September.
And it was really amazing because the poetry was from the time in my life when I probably knew the Corwins the best. You know, 25 years ago when their kids were infants and I was babysitting all the time and we were sharing a backyard. So everything in the poetry sort of brought back that time in my life.
Beard envy. I wish my beard would stop growing. Not be dead, just stop growing. Cut it off and like the lawn in June, after 3 inches of rain in the last 2 weeks, it grows back. Unlike my lawn.
So there's a full hour of these poems on the cassette, all first drafts and rough takes on Swift's life. It was a Christmas present to his parents, his ailing father. But it feels more like a Christmas card, the type that catches relatives up on the mundane happenings of the previous year. There's a poem about catalogs piling up on the Corwins' kitchen table, a strange one about a meal at a Chinese restaurant that doesn't go well, and a lot about his experiences as a forester.
The quiet chap of rain on broad leaves, only from time to time a drop reaching the forest floor.
They're an inner monologue laid out on tape, and the last Christmas gift Swift would give his dad, which makes its final resting place all the more puzzling.
No one can figure out how the tape ended up at the dump. His dad died shortly after he gave it to his parents, and his mother...
The cassette was with her, and then when she died, I don't know where the tape went or how it got into the universe, but it was just somehow circulating with somebody, and it ended up at the dump.
He still hasn't listened to the tape. I think he's something. I'm not sure why he hasn't listened to it. There's something.
I'm nervous too, because the thought of hearing my voice when I was 32 or 33 just gives me a little bit of a pause, and it's kind of like I feel it's like time traveling.
These have been poems by Swift Corwin. Spoken to his parents. Christmas, 1990. I love you both.
Peterborough is a small enough town that if you spend enough time at the dump, this sort of thing is going to happen. And I think this is one of the reasons why people choose to live in places like this, to give yourself more opportunities to have these chance events.
I hate to say this, but I have been more spiritual in my life than I am right now. And if I were really spiritual, I would say that this is God bringing, you know, Caitlin to my tape and Caitlin bringing the tape back to me. Maybe it's my father helping this thing happening, and Caitlin's that conduit. I don't think I'm all that spiritual, so I'm hesitant to say that, but it is a very big coincidence. It's kind of a fun coincidence, actually.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
Like New Hampshire's transfer stations, which bring people together, so does NHPR. If you believe in the power of public radio and the value of being part of the NHPR community, you can show your support now. Here's how.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In March of 1962, Jacqueline Kennedy made a goodwill tour of India and Pakistan. The First Lady famously charmed Indian Prime Minister Nehru and the rest of the world, riding elephants and camels and sightseeing in a dazzling collection of clothes. Things were also fluttering at the ramshackle Jolly Grant home in the Himalayan countryside that same spring. That is the fictional home of Jana Bibi, an expat living among the remnants of the Raj in Uttar Pradesh. Jana Bibi is the creation of New Hampshire author Betsy Woodman, who spent part of her childhood in India. It is the third and final Jana Bibi adventure novel, and it's called Emeralds Included. Betsy will be reading from the book at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord tonight. And on Saturday, she'll be at Toadstool Books in Keene. And we welcome her to Word of Mouth. Hello, Betsy.
Thank you, Virginia. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's so funny to meet you, you know, and think of this Jana Bibi, who seems so exotic. But her story, in a sense, begins in New England with your parents, who I guess had a sense of adventure. Pick up the story for us from there.
They did have a sense of adventure. They were two small town kids who wanted to see the world. My dad came from Franklin. My mom came from Newton, Mass. And they got a chance to go to India, my dad as a cultural affairs officer. And off they went. This sort of horrified their relatives. My mom was 7 months pregnant, and she had two little girls, me and my sister. And India was a lot further away than it is today. I mean, it just took a long time to get there, and not many people had been there, and there weren't too many Indians in this country. And so it was very exotic and very foreign. But we touched down in Madras, now Chennai, and settled in, and were supposed to stay for 2 years and stayed for 10.
So this was between six?
I was six and 16 when we left. So there were 2 years in South India and 8 years in Northern India.
Wow. So you created this character, Jana Bibi. Now, she has some similarities with you. She loves Scottish music, for example.
Yeah.
Any other similarities, or was she kind of a composite of characters you met?
People ask me that. Many of the other characters in the book were composites, or I got the idea because of a real person. But she actually is as close to 100% fictional as you can get.
Okay, give us her background.
Well, she was born in 1902, and so that's the height of the British Raj. And in India, she's born in India and has her childhood there, goes back to Scotland as a late teenager and is miserable for 5 or 6 years and then jumps at the opportunity to return to India. The opportunity happens to be an American missionary who asks her to marry him. So she makes this rather hasty marriage. So in India, she has a number of existences. There's the missionary wife, and then after the husband dies, there's music teacher in Bombay, now Mumbai. And after that, there's violin tutor to a princely family. And then, as my series starts, she gets a letter saying she's inherited a house from her grandfather in the foothills of the Himalayan mountains.
And she becomes a fortune teller.
Now, this is very improbable, and it took some concocting, and also I had a few little twinges of, now, should I really have something this goofy or not? So she gets into this town and learns that it's in danger of being drowned.
By a big dam project.
A hydroelectric project, which actually was part of the background situation in India, because big dams have been part of the development picture. But anyway, so the townspeople in this instance get together and decide to put the town on the map, and they'll make it a tourist destination that's so important and beloved by people that there won't be any question of destroying it. So her role is going to be a fortune teller, and she's going to be in her house, and she's going to have her salon, and the salon is going to be called Jana Bibi's Excellent Fortunes.
What was so much of the energy of the book, I think, comes from this a little bit of zaniness, you know. There's a cast of characters, Mr. Ganguly, her parrot.
He's very important.
A merchant named Mr. Ramachandran. He's a kind of dashing travel writer. A pipe-playing Darzi, you may have to explain that to us, and this a series of bumbling officials. You show a lot of how India doesn't work and works in its own way.
Yeah,
where does that come from, your experience?
I guess. You know, things seem very higgledy-piggledy, but then they kind of work out.
Have you been back recently?
I was back last fall. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are three times as many people as when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And it seems that way. And it looks different. People are wearing Western clothes, young people out on the streets and their motorcycles. In the cities, Delhi, for example, is clogged with traffic of modern cars. You know, the traffic in the old days would be a few cars plus some bullock carts, camels, cows, and bicycles, tons of bicycles, but not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. So it definitely has modernized with a lot of costs, huge air pollution, for example. But the thing that's the same, I think, is that people are very direct and they'll engage you and they won't beat around the bush. They'll ask you immediately about yourself and your life and are you married?
How much you paid for your house.
Exactly. What you earn. So,
we are talking about India now and then, and the then in this case is 1962. That's the year that Jana Bibi's adventure series' most recent book is set. It's called Emeralds Included, and we're speaking with author Betsy Woodman. Well, I'd love to get to that sort of cultural shifting because the 60s, such an important time mm-hmm. in India, fairly new nation mm-hmm. at that time still, or fairly new.
Newly independent nation, right.
At that time. Now, I read a post that you're a guest blogger, and you often write about your experiences growing up in India, and you were there at a time when a lot of people were getting telephones. and this is something that's picked up in the book, this idea that one character says to another, well, if you have a telephone, you won't come over and visit anymore. So I'd love to hear about some of those kind of like social changes or what you were observing growing up.
Right. Well, growing up in Delhi, my family had a phone and it worked. But there were only 7 phone lines for every 100,000 people in the country. So you get out into the bush and no one had a phone. And even up at the boarding school where I went, there were maybe 2 phones. So I had, I think, 1 phone call home in 3 years. Messages were, as in the book, were mm-hmm. Delivered by runners. Now, the vast majority of people have access to a cell phone, mm-hmm. and they've just jumped over the wired era, gone straight into wireless, and it's a huge, huge revolution.
Another shift in the book, there are a pair of twin daughters. Mm-hmm. Their mother is saying, why should they be taking physics? This whole question of, like, a sort of burgeoning consciousness about women or women's rights. And I don't even know if it was there in India in the 60s.
Well, interestingly enough, there have been professional women and women leaders in India way, way before that. And in fact, in Madras, one of the first medical colleges for women was established back in the 19th century. And Indian women and Anglo-Indian women went there. So really, more privileged sector has always had pretty good opportunities for women because they weren't really tied down by housework and so forth. So these girls, their family's a bit traditional, a bit old-fashioned, but they're still going to college. So there is a tension there because they are more modern than their parents.
Well, Jana Bibi's excellent fortunes. She doesn't seem to do a whole lot of business in this book with her fortune telling.
Well, she's not a great businesswoman, and she doesn't have a huge head for money.
But she and her future daughter-in-law, or her daughter-in-law shows that she has some proficiency with this. She grew up in Hungary and says that she learned it. And, of course, everybody in the town follows the What the Stars Foretell column.
Yes, right.
And I'm wondering about this whole kind of specter of, there's a lot of superstition among people, certainly, but this fortune-telling business, this kind of astrological readings, where are you in all of this, Betsy Woodman?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm a very sort of random sample of controlled survey, statistical test for significance kind of girl. But I got to say, I just reserve a little corner of my own mind for fun. And maybe this really was in the cards,
I'm wondering about how this resonates for New Hampshire. Obviously you're writing for a much larger audience than here in New Hampshire, but what it must be like to kind of contact and create and live with these characters while you're in the woods of New Hampshire.
It it was very easy because there were two small towns. I mean, one, the one I was living in and the one I was writing about. There are so many similarities, the sort of intimacy, neighborliness, eccentricity.
Gossip?
Gossip. Oh, my goodness. My dad used to say, you learn about your own indiscretions on the way home from having committed them. So there's a resonance, and even the town's name, Hamara Nagar, means our town, and that was a little joke.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yes, yes.
Well, New Hampshire author Betsy Woodman, what a pleasure speaking with you today.
What fun for me. Thank you so much.
Betsy Woodman's new John Abebe adventure is called Emeralds Included. She's going to be reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord tonight. On Saturday, she will be at Toadstool Books in Keene, and you'll find more on those readings at wordofmouthradio.org. Whether it's heading to a local reading, your town's transfer station, or a drive along the coast, you could be doing it all on NHPR. It is the early bird portion of NHPR's summer car raffle. You can help pay for the programs you love and get a whole lot of free gas. Here's how.